Conservation Room, a place where we talk about the natural world around us, from the wildlife just up the trail to the things growing right beneath our feet. This week, our guest is Susan Elliott from Dartmouth College, who is an ecologist here at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory. And we're going to be talking about the interactions of plants and pollinators today. Welcome, Susan.
Thanks.
Susan, what kind of pollinators do the plants around here have?
Up around here and in many parts of the world, plants have many different types of pollinators, from tiny little flies and beetles up to bigger bees, bumblebees, and hummingbirds. One pollinator we don't have up here are honeybees. They can't grow naturally because they need to live year-round. And so in the winter months, when they don't have enough nectar storage to get through. So up here we have especially a lot of bumblebees, and that's what I study at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab.
And I suppose we also have things like moths and butterflies.
Yeah, moths, butterflies. And they're all coming to these plants to get food. Most of them are either drinking nectar or getting pollen. And the bees are one of the only pollinators that solely rely on flowers for their food source. So they only eat pollen and nectar, both the adults and the offspring.
Well, and they're going after pollen to feed their broods, aren't they, versus other guys who are just sort of using it to power their flight.
Right. All the larvae are fed with only pollen and nectar, so they make kind of a dough of pollen and nectar that they mix together, and they get sugars from the nectar and proteins from the pollen.
So how do you study the interdependence of plants and pollinators?
To understand how plants and pollinators are linked, so plants need pollinators to produce seeds, and especially bee pollinators need the plants to fuel them in flight and also to feed their offspring. And so I work with two species, the big subalpine delphinium, or larkspur, which is in full bloom right now, big stalks of many flowers, and they provide lots of nectar and pollen for the bees. And then I study a big long-tongued bumblebee, one of the biggest that we have around here, a bright golden bee that uses larkspur for its main food source.
Okay, I have to ask, how long is its tongue?
Its tongue is about, I have to remember, I think about 15 millimeters.
Let me see, that's almost, not quite an inch.
Right, not quite an inch, compared to some other bees with maybe half that size.
Okay, so are you telling me that its tongue is as long as, if not longer, than its body?
No, I think this is actually a really big bumblebee.
Oh, how big is it?
I would say that the bee is about a good inch.
Wow.
And the tongue is maybe half that size.
Okay.
The tongue is this big mop that it sticks out, and then it has really kind of like hairs on the end that sop up the nectar and bring it back into the bowl.
Oh, so it's using its tongue for the nectar, and then it's using its legs and everything else to collect the pollen?
Yeah, so that, while the plant might actually like the pollen to just get transferred right over to another flower to produce the seed, the bees actually collect a lot of that pollen, and they're really furry, and so that pollen sticks on their body, and then they brush it and groom it back to their legs where they carry it. So sometimes when you see bumblebees, you'll notice a big orange or yellow or cream-colored ball on its leg. And that's the pollen it's taking back to feed its young.
Wow. So what do you do with these guys?
Well, so my aim is to try to understand, if you have more flowers, will that produce bees that have more offspring and larger, more robust populations? And the reverse, if you have a lot of bees, will that necessarily lead to healthier plant populations? And so what I do is I go out into meadows where there is natural variation in flower density. So some meadows have tons of flowers, and some have just a few. And then I have bumblebee colonies that I raise, and I put them in each of these meadows. And then I try to see, well, if you have a lot of flowers, do you have higher bee reproduction? So it kind of makes sense that more flowers would equal more bees. But what you might alternatively find is that the big meadows with lots of flowers actually have a lot of colonies. So a lot of colonies, each colony may be doing
just as well. Let's back up
here. Yeah.
you just said that you actually put the colonies out there.
Right.
So don't you control the number of colonies in a...
Well, so what I have these kind of control colonies that I use to monitor reproduction. And then they're captive. I can go to them at night and count how many offspring they have, and I can mark them. And
are they in little white boxes?
They are pretty much. White boxes about... 8 by 8 by 8 inches.
A bread box.
Yeah, a bread box. And I stick them out there. Sometimes I let the bees colonize the boxes on their own, or I'll raise them in the lab. And I put plexiglass on top so I can just go over and open the lid and count, oh, how many kiddos have they produced this week? Because they produce more and more workers throughout the season. And then I also, the most challenging part of my research is to find the natural nests.
Which are underground, aren't
right.
they?
Right. So bees, most bees live underground, and these bees use old rodent nests. And so they want to be as inconspicuous as possible because they don't want predators to come and eat their offspring or their honey. And so I have to go searching for these bees, and I've tried techniques such as using handheld radar devices to actually radio track them. That didn't work all that well.
Okay. I'm trying to imagine this.
Yeah.
What, are you putting tiny little transmitters on these bees?
Right. A little transmitter with a 2 to 4 inch wire sticking out the back.
So you have this not quite inch long bee with a 2 or 4 inch tail on it,
yep.
if you will,
yeah.
flying around
yeah.
to its burrow, and then you track it to its burrow.
Right. And unfortunately, this technique is just in the making, and it's not working all that well so far. So we can only track them at about 4 feet away. So we still have to comb through the meadows to find them.
I guess one of the things I wonder about is whether it also affects the survivability
right.
of the bee.
Right, if it might have trouble getting underground. So that was one technique we tried. This year we're actually moving to a more traditional, kind of old school technique of just going out and patiently searching the meadows. Some people are trying to train dogs to find bee colonies. And this year I'm trying a couple things. One, just following bees to see if they're going in a constant direction to find where those nests are. Sometimes we happen upon them by chance. Or also, there's another bee, which is a nest parasite, which finds bumblebee nests and goes and lays its eggs in their nests. So one thing I'm also trying is to follow these nest parasites to see if they lead me to a bumblebee nest. Because they just kind of search around the ground and you can watch them for hours. So that's how we're trying to find the natural nest.
I have to ask, what do these parasitic bees look like?
Well, they look like a big friendly bumblebee just like anyone else, except they're kind of slow. They're not collecting any pollen because they don't have to feed their young. And mostly you just see them kind of flying low. Often I see them on dandelions just sucking up some nectar and crawling along the ground, so a big fuzzy black and yellow bee.
Wow. Well, okay, so bees are pretty small and they can fly quite a distance. So how can you be sure, for instance, that bees have their nest in one meadow, really aren't going over to another meadow, infecting that meadow? And I'm just trying to imagine how you keep track
how
of
do we, yeah.
like this.
It's pretty challenging because they're tiny and they are fast. These are big bees and they just zoom out of there. So what we do is a couple different things. It's really easy to mark these bees with a little dot of paint. So we just buy some regular old paint pens. And I can catch a bee either in the captive colonies, where I can mark a lot of bees at once, or I can go out into the meadows and just catch a bee, and I just put them in a little vial with some mesh on the end. And then I actually push the bee to the end of the mesh with a little sponge plunger. And then I give it a dot of paint and let it go, and it just zooms out of there. And then I keep looking for those bees in a string of meadows where I work. And so I might mark a bee in one meadow with pink paint, and then find it 2 meadows up, maybe 300 meters or 1,000 feet up.
So how do you quantify, then, the effect of that bee on that meadow versus the meadow it came from? I mean, you might see it over there at that meadow, but then, you know, 15 minutes later, it's back in home territory.
Right, and it could also depend on their flight distance, might depend on how much resource is available to them. And so generally what I'm seeing is that bees tend to stay and forage in the same meadows where I mark them, and also where their colonies are. So, if they can fly just a few meters away to get some flowers, some nectar, and
they're happy,
they'll do it. But then later in the season, when flowers start to dwindle but bee numbers are still up, then I start to see them flying farther. So then they might have an effect on an adjacent population of plants. And in addition, we don't know a whole lot about what happens with bee movements across seasons. But you might also imagine that at the end of the year, the colony produces a whole bunch of new queens for the next year. And those queens go out and hibernate. somewhere, but we don't really know how far they go to hibernate, or when they come out of hibernation, where exactly they go to build their new nest. So bees from one meadow may actually be stalking meadows, adjacent meadows, or meadows down the
exploring
down the road
for a new site, basically.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Well, how do you know, you say you go ahead and check your colonies and count. Is that the way you're able to sort of look at your colonies without damaging them and disturbing them? I guess there's a little...
Right. It's just a simple wooden box with a hole for them to go in and out. And I just go to those boxes, and I use a red headlamp because, first of all, it's cold and it's dark, so they won't want to fly. And then I can look into their box and count how many cocoons. So they build these wax cocoons. Mm. I can see how many offspring are in the making. And then after those offspring hatch, then the cocoons remain intact. So at the end of the season, I can count the number of cocoons that were laid and the number that hatched out to know how many offspring were produced.
Hmm. Okay, so you go ahead and you're doing this study. What do you expect the reproductive levels of the bees and the plants to be? How do you expect them to be related? And do you have any data that shows how they are really related?
Well, I kind of went into this thinking, okay, these big meadows with tons of flowers, the bees are going to do really well. But what I found last year, and what I'm repeating in a study this year, is that reproduction seems to be constant across the landscape on a per-colony basis. So each colony does fine. However, the data also suggests from some mark recapture that in meadows with lots of flowers, there are actually more natural colonies. So the number of individuals is correlated. So when you have more flowers, you have more bees, but more bee colonies. So
the average size, it sounds like what you're saying is that each colony basically has an optimum size that it gets to,
right.
And at that point it doesn't want to go further.
Right. They spread their colonies out, so they have more colonies where there are more flowers. So one meadow that doesn't have many flowers, the bees will still do okay in that meadow. They're just less numbers. So if you accidentally wipe out one colony in a little meadow, you're wiping out a big proportion of it.
Well, this is interesting because it sounds like what you're saying is that the bees seem to have a sort of communication system among their various colonies that sort of, they self-regulate their density.
Right, kind of structure. And it's amazing because they form these nests before the main flowers come out. And so they either know from the history of where other nests are, or they have some knowledge of knowing what's going to bloom, so they can predict, this will be a good place to put a colony.
I think that's the most fascinating part, that they must know something about what's going to happen in the future in terms of plants blooming, that they're seeing something out there that we might not be noticing. Maybe they're seeing the number of young plants starting to sprout up, and so they can sort of say, oh, there's going to be so many, and look, Joe is already here,
right.
And Gladys is over there, I better go into the next field over.
Right. So those bees are seeing a lot more than we are.
That is interesting. You're listening to Nature Notes at KBUT. I'm Mel Hart, here with Susan Elliott, and we've been talking about plants and pollinators. Are there other aspects of the system that you're looking at?
Well, so in my dissertation research at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab, I've really focused on reproductive effects on both the plants and the bees. But looking at the spatial scale, watching bees forage among different meadows, and has really made me start to think about the landscape scale of how these bee populations keep going. And so right now, I'm also interested in understanding how bee populations themselves are connected and how this relates to floral resources. So is one meadow with really good resources supplying pollinators either within that season or for another season? And if you have a lot of good resources, are you benefiting not only one population but an adjacent population? And so I'm starting to look at broader scale patterns in bee communities by sampling native bees across the landscape in diverse habitats.
I guess one of the things I didn't ask you, and yet I'm sort of curious about, is you were saying, I guess the other part of it is, how do the plants benefit from all the bees?
Mm-hmm.
How are you measuring the benefit to the plants? Do you sort of count the plants that succeed next year, or do you look at seed production, or how do you do that?
I focus on seed production. However, these are long-lived perennials, so even if they go a year without producing any seeds, they might survive just fine. And I also look at germination rates. So I take those seeds, I say, well, this plant produced, and these plants can produce a few thousand seeds. How many of those can actually germinate to the next year? So it may be that these plants can actually produce a few seeds just by self-pollination without pollinators.
Uh-huh.
But those seeds may not be viable for germinating in the next year. And so I look at natural variation in bee densities, and I also restrict the number of bees that can visit a flower, and then measure seed production.
Then what you have here is a plant producing seeds. The perennials, though, you're saying, are there more or less. And I guess the amount of rain that comes will determine which perennials decide to really shoot up that year, or how big they'll get, or how many flowers they'll produce.
Yeah, or it might be an older plant that stored lots of resources, right, or a good year with lots of flowers. Or it could be the flower that decides to bloom at the right time. So if a flower blooms really early in the season, there may not be enough bees around to get it fully pollinated. But if it blooms late, there may be tons of bees to keep it going.
So from what you've been able to gather, do you see the bees actually making a difference to the plants?
Well, what I see up here is actually, I guess, kind of a positive note on how our bees are doing, is that the plants seem to be fully pollinated. And when pollinator numbers increase, and they increase by an order of magnitude over the blooming season of the larkspur, pollen receipt and seed production does not increase with bee numbers.
Oh, so they're saturated, basically.
They seem to be saturated and doing just fine.
And they saturate every season.
Yeah,
like, huh?
And actually what happens if they get too much pollination and make really big attractive fruits, those fruits end up getting eaten by fly seed predators. So it kind of dampens the benefits of pollination.
Oh, sort of like a bow. It's also, I guess, a natural regulator
right.
in the system.
Yeah.
How old do these delphiniums get to be?
I think they can live up to 70 years.
70
right.
years? Human lifespan.
So, right. I might be able to follow one.
I have new respect for these delphiniums.
It is. It's amazing. And what's also kind of scary at the same time is these plants can just keep going and going. And that if we may not be able to know what's happening to their bee populations because there's a time lag between plant life cycles and bee life cycles.
So you're expanding your whole system of study to wider ecosystems, I guess. Why are you interested in these wider ecosystems and the interaction between bees and plants?
Well, I think it's really important as we as humans continually change and modify the landscape to know which habitats are important habitats for example, harboring rich pollinator populations. And we need these native pollinators not only to pollinate our gardens and the native wildflowers, but also farms rely on adjacent wildland habitats to produce pollinators to pollinate their crops.
Now, how are you studying the relations among bee populations?
Well, what I'm looking for is I'm sampling bee communities, so many different species of bees in adjacent habitats. And what I'm looking for is for evidence of temporal or spatial synchrony. So if there are populations that have the same species and kind of are doing the same things at the same time, so bees change over the season, then that will suggest that those populations could be linked. And so they may be important populations for each other as well as for the plants in those populations.
What have you found out so far about wild bee communities?
Well, I'm just getting into the wild bee study right now, but I'll have to say the most exciting thing I'm finding is the diversity of beautiful bees that I'm finding. The sampling technique is really easy. We just set out little bowls of soapy water in the morning and then go on with our day and come back in the evening and collect
them.
They
like soapy water?
Well, so I'm not sure if they're attracted to the water or the colors. So we set out blue, white, and yellow bowls, and the bees come as well as flies, and they just get trapped and drown right away. And so it's
cruel.
I know. It's a bit hard. But then we can go back to the same sites and there's still tons of bees. So we're...
You're not making a big impact.
We
How many different kinds of bees have you been finding?
Oh, we've been sampling for about 10 sampling bouts right now. And it's interesting, we'll get a few species, 4, 5, 6, or 7, that we only get a few of those individuals, and then there's a couple species where we get the majority of the bee species. So
you're saying that you're looking at a system that stretches on the outside to maybe a dozen species altogether?
In a location, we'll get maybe a dozen species at one point in time, but we're looking at locations throughout the season. So some bees come out early in the season, some come out later.
So the total number over all the seasons, how many different bees are there?
Oh, I bet we'll get hundreds.
100 different species?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, that's really interesting.
And these are all bees that you never notice just by walking around looking at flowers. There's actually a lot more out there than we realize.
Wow. You're listening to Nature Notes at KBUT. I'm Mel Hart here with Susan Elliott, and we've been talking about plants and pollinators. Well, thanks, Susan, for talking to us today about your research. Do you have a nature note you'd like to share with us?
Well, just one quick observation that I've made about how we observe nature is that I've learned a lot about focusing on bees and watching bees. My eyes are trained to catch a bee many feet away from me. But I've also learned a lot from being out in the field with kids. And what I notice is that kids have less focus onto what they're looking for, and so they actually notice a lot more. And it's been with children that have actually shown me, hey, Susan, there's eggs coming out of that bee. It's laying eggs. And I think, oh my gosh, I've never seen this before. Or that bee looks really sick. Its stomach is lying on the floor. And so as I, on one hand, really focus my attention to really find one species or answer one question, I also have to realize that remembering how to learn like a child and feel like a child is really helpful as well.
It's very interesting because there's a certain amount of irony. You think that someone who can't focus that well on one thing isn't going to be noticing much else, but what you're saying is it just sets them free to start looking at a whole bunch of other things.
They actually see so much.
That's interesting. Well, my nature note is a sweet little vignette I'll treasure for some time to come. Back in June one day, I took a break from my writing and went down the hillside outside our cabin looking at wildflowers. As I bent down close to look at some blossoms, I chanced to look just a few inches above them. Coiled in the grass was a very young fawn, very quietly resting. I quietly stole away to the house and brought my camera and my husband out. John's sharp eyes spied another fawn 10 feet away from the first, also quietly resting. And we saw a doe further up the hill, uncertainly grazing. But I've never been so close to a fawn out here in Colorado before. And I got some great pictures, while resisting the temptation, of course, to touch the deer fawns. But what a great nature break. My tip of the week to every individual that wants to help solve global warming is wash your clothes with cold water whenever possible. It uses up much less energy and will usually get your clothes just as clean. Check to make sure you're not using too much detergent. Only use your washing machine when you have a full load. How you wash your clothes makes a big difference in terms of the energy you consume. To you, our listening audience out there, if you would like to be a part of natural history, think about joining the Friends of the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab, located in beautiful downtown Gothic, Colorado, at the base of beautiful Gothic Mountain. Friends are invited to special Rumble events and get discounts on others. Get involved with the lab and learn more about the natural world the lab is exploring. The lab has a weekly public seminar series, offers monthly history tours and botanical tours on Friday mornings throughout July, as well as several special events. We have a kids' nature camp for 6 to 8-year-olds on Monday and Tuesday mornings, for 4 to 5-year-olds on Wednesday mornings and afternoons, and for 9 to 11-year-olds on Thursdays, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. In conjunction with this program, Cresta Butte is running a free public bus service from CB to Gothic with stops in Mount CB, in case you want to bus up for a quick hike in the morning. Join us this Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. in the Rumble Dining Hall. Angus McIntosh from the University of Canterbury, New Zealand, will give a talk entitled Interactions Across Riverscapes, How the Configuration of Stream Environments Shapes the Strength of Predator-Prey Interactions. Then join Rumble director Ian Billick for a wildflower research tour at Rumble. Visit research sites at the Rumble facilities as Ian discusses the nature of the research project. This tour ends at the dining hall, where you will enjoy a gourmet dinner prepared by our talented staff, all for the incredible price of $35. Please reserve 24 hours in advance. For more information on any of this, contact the office at 349-7231 or check online at www.rmbl.org. That's our show for today. To all you out there, remember that if you have a garden near wilderness, try to cultivate only native flowers. Or if you must have domestic flowers, make sure to harvest them before their seeds can invade the wilderness. Foreign plants have already invaded wildflower habitat, pushing out natives. Let's do our part to help the wildflowers, not make it worse. Tread lightly and in harmony upon this earth. Have a good time out there checking out the natural world. Enjoy it, respect it, and do your part to preserve it. Stay tuned. Coming up next is National Public Radio. Till next time, this is Mel Horn. Bye-bye.
Graveyard shift midnight to dawn. Oh, the moon was as bright as a reading light for a letter from an old friend back home. And he asked me, why do you ride for your money? Why do you roll for short pay? You ain't getting. Sure miss the track when you never come back. She's a perfect professional's wife. And she asked me, why does he ride for his money? Why does he roll for short pay?